One of the questions I've been asked a lot since October 7th is, why do you stand up? What makes you use your voice? And the more I think about it, the odder those questions seem to me, because the answer should be obvious, right? I stand up and use my voice for the same reason that every Jew and every ally who is standing up uses theirs. Because we have to. There is rabid, widespread, normalized Jew hatred throughout the world like we haven't seen in decades. In our schools, our institutions, our workplaces, our media, the very neighborhoods where we live. And of course, there's, you know, the horrific atrocities committed by Hamas on October 7th and every single day since. So I think the better question is, if you're someone who isn't standing up or speaking out, why not? Like, if you haven't spoken up yet, what would it take to get you to speak up? How bad does it have to be for Jews for you to think it's worth saying something? What does that look like? Really think about it. Because from where I'm sitting, it's already looking pretty bad. 360 free-spirited young Jews were mowed down at a dance party. That's 6 times more people than have been killed at any mass shooting event in American history. And that wasn't enough for you to say anything. Jewish families were burned alive. Jewish infants shot in their cribs. Jewish peace activists butchered and kidnapped. Still, didn't say anything. Jewish college students were barred from entering school buildings, mocked and isolated by professors and students alike simply for being Jewish, and you said nothing. Radical Islamists in masks burned American flags on the campuses of our most hallowed universities, waved terrorist banners, chanted for the genocide of the Jewish people, and that still wasn't enough for you to say anything. Violent mobs assaulted Jews in LA, Montreal, Brooklyn, Amsterdam. Synagogues and day schools were firebombed, desecrated, vandalized in Tunisia, Toronto, Sydney. And he didn't say anything. Iran launched enough rockets to blow the civilian population of Israel into oblivion, targeting innocent Jews, Christians, Muslims. And you said nothing. Terrorists paraded Israeli hostages on stage, surrounded by thousands of rapturous Jew-hating Palestinians and their children, who all seemed to be a lot better clothed and fed than the emaciated hostages they held in tunnels and civilian homes for over a year. They traded the body of a toddler they kidnapped and executed in exchange for the release of multiple mass murderers. They broke the ceasefire by missing deadlines. They broke the ceasefire by firing a rocket that killed a Gazan teenager. They broke the ceasefire by swapping out Shiri Bibas's body just to torture everyone a little more. And you said nothing. People drew swastikas on posters of a 9-month-old Jewish baby who had been kidnapped from his bed. 500-plus days later, that baby came back strangled to death, body mutilated, his tiny coffin filled with terrorist propaganda materials. And that wasn't enough for you to say anything. So again, I have to ask, if none of that was enough for you to speak up, what could it possibly take to get you there? Seriously, how much worse does it have to be for you to say, this is bad, I should say something? Now, for those of you who have totally spoken up, but maybe only quietly or only online or only once, what is it you're waiting for? Really think about what your answer might be. And if you're someone who remains committed to silence in the face of these abject horrors, at least have the fortitude to search yourself and be honest about why, where you really stand, if you stand for anything at all. As for the rest of us, I have a bitter pill that I need you to swallow. Here's the truth. Nobody else is coming. Nobody else is coming. Accept it. Embrace it. Breathe it out. Stop waiting for your favorite celebrity or your friend from college to do the right thing. Stop hoping, stop raging, stop being shocked when they disappoint you. If they haven't said anything yet, that is a choice they've made, and they're probably not going to say anything now. But on the off chance they do at last wake up out of their brainwashed, cowardly stupor, we can all be pleasantly surprised and welcome them warmly back to reality. Though it'll likely only be when it's become socially acceptable and therefore easy to do without exhibiting any integrity, or when it's already too late to make a difference. But it's okay. It's okay. We got this. We are more than capable of holding it down as we are. If We are each of us active and unified. Don't wait for someone to tell you you're needed to jump into the fray. You're needed now. What else could you possibly be waiting for? This is the 23rd episode of Being Jewish with me, Jonah Platt. My guest today may have retired 8 years ago, but you'd certainly never know it from all the work he's doing around the world to support the Jewish people. His namesake footwear brand is globally renowned for its stylish and functional women's shoes, adored by consumers and mega celebrities alike, and my wife, Courtney. Weekly shout out to Courtney. But even more impressive is the unbelievable impact he is making through his philanthropy, supporting Jewish community, history, and ensuring a vibrant Jewish future. Today, we're here to talk about Jews, shoes, and the man that keeps them moving. Please welcome the innovative Stuart Weitzman.
I like that, Jews and shoes.
There you go, yeah, right?
Somehow they came together.
Yeah. Stuart, first of all, speaking of shoes and Jews, does anybody ever call you Stuart?
Just you?
Yes. I was hoping I'd be the first.
But if you said Shoey, then it would have been a lot of people.
Really?
Well, Stewie, Shoey, you know.
Oh, cute. Okay, Stuart. Shoe business, always a family affair for you, right?
My dad was in it.
Yeah.
My brother was in it, and I didn't plan to be in it.
Right.
I was going to Wall Street, you know, and break the bank. But circumstances sometimes change your direction.
Were you involved at all growing up, like going into just, you know, see dad at work or
no,
any of that?
Nothing. No, not until, I guess, after college, because I decided I wanted to be in the shoe business. So I did work for my brother for a while and then went out sort of on my own with some backers.
Okay, so yeah. Until then you were doing your own thing, but
I was at with the Wharton School studying finance and ready to go to Goldman Sachs and that kind of world.
Were you always into drawing and designing? Was that
something? Was a hobby. Mm-hmm. It was not going to be a career. Picasso, I was not.
Uh-huh.
But I loved doing it and I continue to do it and I ended up working at my hobby. That's cool.
That is very cool. That's the dream.
That should be everybody's goal.
Right. Was it for you more about like the art, like you liked doing all kinds of different things, or was the design and you want to like, you know, create something?
I never drew a shoe,
huh.
But in college, a friend of mine said to me one day after he saw me painting the scenes for Mask and Wig, that's like Hasty Puddings at Harvard. It's a
comedy
drama
group
school.
At Penn. Short story. I auditioned for Mask and Wig when I was at Penn as
okay,
an undergrad.
Okay, then you know what I'm talking
and
about.
And I got in, but I ended up not doing it because I did an a cappella group instead. And I've been told I'm known as the one who got away.
That's good.
Yeah. All right, keep going.
Yeah, so he said, you know, why don't you draw some shoes? I said, well, why do I want to do that? He said, well, my dad has a factory in Brooklyn and he's a great shoemaker. He buys his designs outside, freelance, we call it.
Mm-hmm.
I said, hey, I don't know. Bring me his catalog. I'll look at it, see what he makes, and maybe I can make some sketches for him. So I did. Drew 20 sketches.
All women's shoes?
He only made lady shoes.
Okay.
I brought him to his house over a holiday Sunday. With my friend was there, of course, with his dad. And I laid him out, you know, like you would a deck of cards, maybe. Uh-huh. I fanned him out, yeah. And he pulled one from the middle. He looked at it. He said to me, I make medium price shoes. So once in a while, I will copy a high-priced shoe, but I must know whose shoe it was. So who'd you copy this from? I smell that as a challenge, you know. And I didn't copy it, so it was not a take-back. And I said, gee, I didn't, sir. I drew this as I thought would be something that looks like what you sell now, but with a new twist. And he put it up to the chandelier, looked at it again, and there was an outline, because when I started, I drew the outline, and then I filled in what I thought would be a cute design. He said, I can see you traced this shoe. I said, gee, I really didn't, sir, but I didn't expect to sell you anything. I'm out here because Larry suggested it, and I started kind of trying to put them back together, you know, and scoop them up and adios. And he tore it up. He just tore it up.
Why?
Threw it on the ground and rumbled it up.
Dramatic.
I looked at my friend. He looked at me. What the hell is it? And he just let us sweat for about 15 seconds. And he picked another one up. Well, I'm thinking, oh, my God, what's he going to? And he said to me, did you draw this one also? I said, yes, I did, sir. He gave me a lesson I used my entire career. He took my sketch and he flipped it over, put it on the table, gave me a pencil, draw it for me again. So he had flipped it to the blank side.
Right.
And I went, you know, I did because I had drawn it. I picked it up, looked at it, looked at the original. And he said, I'll give you $20 a sketch.
What's the lesson in that?
The lesson is when I have interviewed designers who show me these beautiful portfolios, I say, show me one of your favorite shoes. And she flips to something, points to it, close the book. And on another chair, I have a piece of paper. Draw me your favorite shoe again.
I love that.
And this is the truth. Of about 15 interviews, only 6 could redraw the shoe.
Come on.
Now, I don't mind if someone uses a stylist to draw their idea. That's okay. Creativity.
Yeah, that's
but
fair.
When they present it as theirs, And I will tell you something else.
Yeah.
It still ticks me off. He didn't pay me for the one he tore up.
Yeah, hello.
He wheeled off 19 $20 bills, $380. I sold him about $3,000 worth of sketches that senior year. My tuition, for anyone who's listening that's at college now, was $1,740 at the Wharton School.
Wow.
And now
times
now
have
it's
changed.
85,000, you know. So I never told my dad. I was the king of the campus. I was bringing in rock groups for parties. I had so much cash coming in.
Wow.
It was great, but I loved it. And I thought, wow, this is, you can make money. It was an hour and a half work for $380. Today would be 2,000 maybe.
And you didn't feel exploited at all that he's about to take these designs
and run?
You're not getting
them.
A royalty?
You sell them. I was no established designer. There are designers who maybe get a fee per pair. I was happy to sell the sketches.
Right.
But what sold me on entering this industry and giving up Wall Street, that summer on Fifth Avenue, you probably know where Bergdorf Goodman is.
Of course.
Across the street right now is Bulgari.
Okay.
It used to be the I. Miller shoe store, the best, highest grade shoe store in New York City. And I'm walking down Fifth Avenue and I see a shoe looks like something. Wow, big bow pump with fluffy snake and leather bow. I pushed my nose up against the window to see the label in the shoe. It was the name of the company I sold my sketches to. He made that shoe and he sold it to the best store in New York. I went in and asked about it. They told me they had just placed a reorder.
That's validation right there.
I canceled Wall Street and found a shoe job to learn the trade, and that's where it started.
When you say found a shoe job, did you go with your family or you went and did something else?
No. I knew that I wanted to make a luxury shoe, quality shoe. Mm. I did what a kid would do if he wants to go to college. I researched different companies, and I found one that was making the best shoe for its price in America. I said, that's the kind of company I want to work for. I'll learn a lot from them because they're doing what I hope to do in 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to work for them.
That's awesome. And I believe I've read something you said to the effect of, don't start your own company right away.
You know what I learned in those 5 years?
Yeah, wasn't your money on the line.
And all the mistakes we made that didn't cost me, but I learned from them.
Yeah.
And the customers I met and the tanneries I met for the leather and the accessory manufacturers.
Right.
I even took 3 people with me when I started. 3 people that I had worked with now for 4 years already. 4 to 5 years. You can't find that quickly. It can take you 10 years to find 3 great people.
1986, you start Stuart Weitzman.
Yeah.
Bold move. You're putting your name on it. This is my thing. I'm ready to go.
It wasn't bold. I had people to join me.
Mm-hmm.
I had saved some money. I had been doing it well for them. So I just said,
it's your time.
My time.
What happens that really jumpstarts Stuart Weitzman in its upward trajectory?
I got lucky.
It always takes a little bit of luck somewhere.
Yeah, but you know, if you don't buy the lottery ticket, can you win the lottery?
Right.
I bought the lottery ticket. I decided to take a risk, a big risk. I took a third of my capital that I had saved in those 6 years that I was using to start a company. And I took a third of it and I had built for me a mini shoe factory that would just make one pair at a time, not mass production.
Okay.
And I did that because I noticed on the red carpet, in all those events, everyone had a custom-made dress, but the actresses were overlapping in their footwear. The stylist would go to a store, buy it to go with the dress, and they didn't pay attention if someone other stylist bought the same stuff. I thought, if I can do for footwear what Valentino and Armani are doing for dresses, maybe I found my niche. So I needed this factory to make one-of-a-kind shoes. And the first season, I called the stylist. I met at the previous job, which is where that benefit came in. Mm-hmm. And I said, I'm going to be doing this. If you ever get a client, think of me. She said, oh, I just signed up Aretha Franklin.
Oh, yeah, I heard of her.
Oh, yeah. I said, whoa. I said, I'd love to show her some designs to go with her outfit. So she sent me a sketch of the dress. I sent her four sketches. They picked one. I made the shoe, and she decided she's going to wear it to the Grammys. I said, you know, they're not going to ask her about her shoes on the red carpet. They never do. Whose jewelry? Who did your hair? Mm-hmm. Of course, the dress. Forget it. Shoes are hidden under the dress, or they don't want to pay attention. I said, so as a favor, since I'm making you this custom shoe, ask her to say, after they ask about the dress and before they move on, oh, and by the way, Stuart Weitzman, how about that? She said, well, you know, I don't, she's up for the Grammy. She's got a lot to worry about, but I'll mention it to her. The award comes, the ceremony's on, and she wins. She wins. I didn't know she's going to win.
Right.
She's in front of 30 million people. She's got the trophy in her hand, and she takes off her shoes and holds them in the other hand like this with the label facing out. And she said, after she thanked her writer, her mother, you know what they do, right?
Right, yeah.
And, she said, and I also want to thank Stuart Weitzman for making me these beautiful and oh so comfortable shoes. 30 million people.
You couldn't put a price on that kind of advertising.
Within a month, there wasn't a stylist in Hollywood that didn't call me. And before I'm selling shoes to the public, I am now the shoemaker to the stars. That's what launched my career.
That is unbelievable.
It was lucky, but I bought the ticket.
Right.
And once you have that crowd,
that's it.
It's giving credibility, not by advertising. Remember, these are their choices, which is different than buying an ad.
This is even better.
Of course. Credibility for it. Once you have that, the image of the brand is higher than the price I put on it. Because traditionally, the higher the price, the higher the image. Mm-hmm. And I was not making shoes in the stratosphere.
Right.
I was making entry point luxury, let's say.
Right, which is exactly what my wife said to me when I told her I was interviewing you. She's like, tell Stuart I love him, and his shoes are like so affordable for what they are. They're not like these crazy stratospheric prices.
Well, but having the celebrities behind me gave credibility.
Mm-hmm. I love that story.
And I made enough money to do a lot of wonderful things for the rest of the world.
Which we'll certainly get into. But first, I have to ask the most important question of this interview. At what point did you cross paths with my grandfather of blessed memory, Howard Platt, who—
Did you know Howard?
Did I know? Oh, yes, of course.
So
I knew
he was
him.
Alive while you were growing up?
Oh, yes. He died during COVID.
He died from COVID?
Not from, but like during that time.
He was a wonderful guy. Of course, a mentor kind of guy to me. I was like 27 years old, and he was my first independent customer, as opposed to Macy's or Dillard's or Bloomingdale's.
Was this when he was with U.S. Shoe?
No. Han Shoe Company.
Han Shoe Company, that's
and
right.
He was the head honcho there, and he took a liking to me. I remember he said to his buyer, after he reviewed the line and showed what he liked, he says, I'd give him an order. He's a nice Jewish kid trying hard. It's just what he said to him.
I believe that.
That's what he said.
He's the
and I
the
got
nicest,
an order,
sweetest
and I was
guy.
Selling within three seasons, 11 stores. He was a big account.
That's awesome.
And paid the bills. And because of his range of location, other little stores came to me, noticed me, and said, oh, I saw your shoes at Han. Maybe they were 30, 40 miles away in another town. He helped me start my business.
I love that.
I told that to your mom when I first met her.
That's very special. The only two people whose answering machines I've ever gotten that say, leave your name and shoe size are you and my grandfather.
Did he say that too?
Always, yeah, for years it was always.
I have a list of over 100 young ladies. I know their shoe size.
Yeah, I would imagine. You know, I feel like most people in my audience probably don't know this, that my grandfather started as a department store shoe salesman. Yeah. and then worked his way up, and he's running Han, and then he was running U.S. Shoe that owned a bunch of retail stores. I love that our family paths crossed in that way. Something else you did is you moved your production to Spain.
The American shoe industry was dying. It didn't take long. In 5 years, it was over.
How much did you know about the Jewish history of Spain when you started spending time there?
A fair amount. I read Netanyahu's book about the Inquisition, his brother's book, the fellow was killed in Uganda in that raid. Truthfully, I don't think I met a non-Jewish person growing. I grew up in a synagogue of a city.
Okay.
I didn't really attach and get involved in the community because it was always there.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to Wharton, which they called the University of Pennsylvania. It was our nickname when I went there, 42% of the whole university.
Yeah. Well, it's looking different now, but we'll get into that.
But then I married a Southern girl, a wonderful gal who was one of a few kids in her high school that was Jewish. And she taught me the heritage, really, and the love for it. We went to Israel and bought mitzvahs of our daughter there and just started to get involved. She in particular, who had more time, of course, than me, and became president of this, involved in that, and all different, you name the organization, she's had a few years at least with it. I became very, very proud of where I came from. I learned more when I took my two kids to Amsterdam. I wanted them to see
the Anne Frank House,
right? Mm-hmm. They wanted to see the red light district, but that had to come after.
Yeah.
So we went to Anne Frank's house. I wanted them to have that heritage. And then we went to Oslo. In Oslo is the Nobel Prize Museum.
Mm-hmm.
No, I'm sorry. It's in Stockholm.
Okay.
It was founded by a Norwegian, Alfred Nobel, but he put it in Sweden to keep the family politics apart from it.
Okay.
Good idea. And I remember taking her to the Jewish nation, as it was called. 32% of all Americans who won Nobel Prizes were Jewish. Now, I knew that. And I wanted them to know that. If I said it, it goes in here and out the other ear.
Right.
But for them to read it, and I think 23 of all prizes
It's like 22% or something. We just had one of them on this show, Dr.
Really?
Drew Weissman.
Yeah, it became a big part of my life. And I began to give talks about why Jewish culture and heritage is so important. Even if you think man created God doesn't get in the way of being who we are and Jewish and what we can be proud of. I mean, my God, the seven companies in Hollywood, all Jewish founders.
Mm-hmm.
Broadway, can I ask you a question?
Yeah, of course.
What percentage of Broadway musicals do you think have had a Jewish playwright or lyricist?
Or?
One or the other.
It's got to be something like 85%.
Try 97.
Oh, my gosh, 97.
I did a documentary for public television that they still run called The Broadway Musical, A Jewish Legacy. It's a wonderful story about, goes back from Berlin and up to today, up to Book of Mormon, which is Jewish writers. And that made me proud.
Yeah.
It really did. It was quite exciting. I found an essay by Mark Twain.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking 150 years ago.
Right.
And in it, Mark Twain says, in spite of their infinitesimal size of population and the pressures they've been under by their surrounding citizens, the Jews have accomplished more than nations of 100 million. That was 150 years ago. Now, I think of it as, I think of today's, you know, from Hollywood on up, that's what, and Einstein, or that's what, and maybe the kids today are thinking of Zuckerberg and Sergey Brin. And
yeah.
So my ending line is, you're the ones to make sure that your children have that kind of success and heritage to fall back on. And it goes back before Mark Twain, no doubt, but he actually wrote a whole essay about it.
Wow.
Who would have ever thought back then?
He was a smart guy. That's amazing. What do you think it is about hooking into this heritage that, you know, felt like such a natural source of pride for you where it isn't for everybody?
Well, they don't know. They don't know. I just spoke at Smith College,
mm-hmm.
and there were four Jewish young women who were in a one-on-one kind of conference I held after my talk. And I asked them, have you ever read the Hamas Charter? What's that? And that's probably 90% or more of the Jewish population.
Yeah.
If they could read, that's, by the way, the constitution of the Palestinian Hamas Authority.
I've read it.
They may be hiding behind a tree. Yep. The tree yells out, there's a Jew behind me, come get me. Don't go to peace conferences. That's a Western scam. Mm-hmm. We have a jihadist requirement from generation to generation to kill them all. And when we're done with them, the Christians, and then they feel sorry, you know, for what's going on. And of course, you can have empathy for all people who get killed in any war, but they have no idea about what a country like Israel is up against.
Yeah.
You have assassins at their door basically forever.
Yeah.
Because those kind of ideologies you can't erase.
No.
How many years did it take for the Catholic Church to accept us as a fine civilization? 500 years. Muslims could take, like they say, if it's 1,000 years, we're going to do more October 7th.
Right.
And Jewish people just don't know about that. They don't know the PLO charter either, which is the same thing. Arafat promised to change it. He never had a vote on it.
A lot of things he said he was going to do and didn't do, huh?
And he won the Nobel Peace Prize. They should have
they're just giving them out. Getting back to Spain, which is how we started down this whole road. I read in a Jerusalem Post article that you were surprised at how little Spain knows of its own Jewish history.
No, they don't. They never taught it. I remember when I owned a factory to start my business in Spain. We ended up with 11, but the first one, I said to the partner's son, have they taught you about Torquemada in school? And he said, in school? You mean the bar at the end of the road here? Not only did he not know who the heck Torquemada was, he thought they named the bar after him.
Wow.
But
that's
when
shocking.
They just named it as the chief inquisitor, a fine, upstanding person in the church, is in their mind. They don't know what the hell he did and how responsible he was for the Inquisition. It's not; it wasn't taught. And now I'm behind building a new museum there to educate them.
Let's get into
that. Is that a segue I just led you into?
Thank you.
In case you weren't aware of it.
Speaking of, so you are on the board of trustees of this new Hispanic Jewish museum.
Hispano-Judeo.
Yeah. It's going to be in Madrid?
In Madrid.
How did you get involved, and what's the approach of that museum? Like, what are you trying to accomplish there?
Okay. David Hatchwell, president of the Madrid Jewish community, and his father was a big deal in the Jewish world before him. I met him at a conference of presidents, which is a Jewish get-together, presidents of Jewish organizations.
Yep. My mom's been there.
Yeah. And he said, I have an idea. We're now accepting in Spain, he's a Spanish citizen, any Sephardic Jew as an automatic citizen. The king and parliament has passed a law giving that citizenship to anyone who can show a quarter heritage of Sephardic relatives. And we've already got over 10,000 who've returned. They have to live there, become a citizen automatically. And now it's over 30,000, mostly South Americans. I feel that there's a rebirth happening because we're not talking about taxi drivers coming back to Spain. These are business people, professors, cultured.
Wow.
He said, I'd like to do a museum. I said, what does it take aside from money? Because there's politics here. So we need a building from the state. But the state is the one who created this law because they want to bring the Jewish people back for tourism and for the culture of it. And I think that they would be open to it. And we met with the mayor of Madrid and other places, and Madrid was open to the idea. It took 3 years of politics, but they approved it last year, and we're now in construction of the museum. And the goal of the museum, of course, we had to present a plan. It will have classes there for students from eighth grade on up to through high school on their history and the Jewish culture. And I learned things, for example, the cabinet of Isabella. She ran the show. Ferdinand didn't. She ran the show. Her cabinet had 10 ministers. 7 were Jewish. That's how high the Jewish population reached in society. It was about 20%.
Until they weren't.
Until they weren't. Yeah, well, half left. The other half were forced to take Catholic names, become Catholic, and they those with certain interests stayed for that reason. Where were they going to go? But others just took the shot and went. And that's where the diaspora all around Northern Europe, Holland, et cetera, happened. A lot of them went with Columbus on his trips back to America, founded the colonies in the Carolinas, in Charleston, the first one, in Savannah, and engaged in financing the revolution with the Levi family and others. So that history we're talking about, and it's quite exciting. I'm learning it as we're planning our programs in this university.
Are you familiar with the work of Dara Horn, the writer?
Yes.
I'm having her on the show.
Oh, wow.
She talks about, you know, the failings of many Holocaust museums and how they...
This is not a Holocaust museum.
Oh, I know, of course. But how they sort of don't illustrate the continuum of Jewish life and persecution. Yeah. And so there's no pattern recognition there. It feels like here's this random thing that happened, and then everybody was
And
fine.
They show the same exhibition, and it's...
How truthful is this museum going to be about, you know, the many ways in which the Jews were really, you know, persecuted and killed and kicked out?
It will be, but not in the classes of the young kids.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, they will be, and there'll be plenty of lectures and exhibitions. We have the Catholic Church has agreed to loan us, not give us, loan us, Jewish artifacts that were used by the conversos. Mm-hmm. Do you know what they were?
Are they the ones who did it, stayed Jewish in secret?
In secret.
Right.
First they were conversos, then they did it in secret, and they were the ones who were burned at the stake in the Inquisition. If you didn't continue your Judaism, they didn't bother you. But there were many that continued it in secret, in rooms, the secret rooms, and candles on Friday night, whatever traditions they could hang on to. So they're going to loan us Jewish artifacts that they confiscated after the Jews were killed. And they're also going to give us the machinery that was created to torture the Jews.
Wow.
Because the goal was to get every Jew they found practicing Judaism, every Catholic they found still practicing his Judaism, to give names of others. Mm. And if you look at some of the things they invented, picture the telephone booth, the old-fashioned telephone booth. With 1 foot spikes
it's
on
the
every
Iron
wall.
Maiden, right?
Yeah, and they close in on you. Mm-hmm. And they have this big wheel that they call the rack.
The rack.
And they put you on your back.
Mm-hmm.
And then narrowed it as your back got a little bit smaller and cracked and, you know, paralyzed you, but didn't kill you. And for who knows, 24 hours or whatever.
It's brutal.
They had a stretching machine. Stretched the body 12 inches. I saw one that stretched the body 12 inches before it actually split.
Ugh.
This machinery is, it'll be on display.
And will they explore, discuss the flourishing of the Jewish community under the Moors, not the Catholics?
It's all us. So we're going to have all of that and great Jewish leaders that...
I think a lot of people probably don't know that like the time of great prosperity for
the
Jews. Yeah,
it was 700 years.
The golden age was under the Muslims.
Yeah. The Muslims lost the war, so they left.
Right.
And at the same time, Torquemada convinced Isabella, the Muslims are leaving because we just beat them. Let's get rid of the Jews at the same time.
We don't need them to finance the war anymore.
No, and we don't need them to influence our children. I mean, there are stories of housemaids baptizing children of their Jewish
owners, they were working
for. And once they're baptized, they have to leave the Jewish house. So they would steal the children that way and raise them in Catholic families.
When is it supposed to open?
Next March.
All right, so plenty of trips to Spain, March 26. Yeah. So let's get into more of your philanthropy. So we've just started touching it a little bit. As much as you're a role model for your business acumen, you really are a role model as a philanthropist, truly. And you do it in such a Jewish way. And it's a great, really, truly a great role model for anybody looking at what they should do if they have the opportunity to give away money in a meaningful way.
Well, listen, let me tell you something. What am I going to do with it?
Well, a lot of people buy 15 yachts and a private island, and you're not at all.
Now, a lot of people don't do that.
Some of them do.
They make noise who do that.
Uh-huh.
But I have asked friends of mine, much, much wealthier than I, what are you going to do with your money?
Mm-hmm.
And they don't know. If my check to the funeral parlor doesn't bounce, you know, I haven't done a good job giving away my money.
You can't take it with you.
I never saw a U-Haul being pulled by a hearse, have you?
Right.
Okay.
That's right. We're going to get into a lot of the different things you've done with your philanthropy, but one is you've created a number of meaningful initiatives to bring business opportunity to others. Can you talk about one or two of your favorite initiatives or contests you guys have run?
I do visit about 25 universities every year.
Mm-hmm.
And I started that a little bit before I sold out, when I had to stay a year or two to, you know, show them what to do, but extensively since this is my act two. And when I go to these schools, I do meet between 6 and 10 or 12 of them for one-on-one sessions.
Cool.
I'm not trying to be, you know, DEI directed here, but if there are Jewish students there, I hang on to them. They'll relate to me.
Yeah.
But others as well.
Sure.
And they're the ones who want to meet me one-on-one. It's not by chance. They've given a good reason to the dean or provost why they'd like to spend a few hours with Stuart. And they get selected, and usually because they have a startup or an idea, and I help them get in business, and I teach them the many truisms of entrepreneurship, because there are many that if you follow them, it's hard to go wrong. It really is. And I feel proud about that. There's a guy who wanted to create a dance shoe. And the reason he wanted to create, he was at Wharton.
Okay.
He dances, ballroom dancing. He says, and the shoes are lousy. I said, what's wrong with them? He says, they're too damn stiff. And we're moving, we need the agility. And they won't let us wear sneakers. So I found him a factory. I showed him my marketing tools. I said, you will need to have someone or some organization that you can hang your hat on. You can't do it alone. And you are not famous.
Mm-hmm.
Like I had Aretha, right?
Right?
Or Jennifer Aniston, now Kate Middleton, Beyonce. I knew about that world. And he went after Dancing with the Stars. But I told him, I did not try to sell Bergdorf Goodman until I knew my shoe could sit on the same table with Manolo Blahnik.
Mm-hmm.
I'm selling stores really like Han and independent shoe stores where Louboutin and Jimmy Choo is not present to compare. And when I felt I was right, then I went after that level. And he was a creative guy. He invented a dance shoe where the sole is in the forepart and the heel. And the arch area has no sole. And it's totally flexible.
Mm.
And it allows for all the moves that these dancers make, if you ever watch that show.
Yeah, my wife's a professional dancer.
Well, maybe she uses Fuego shoes.
I'm sure she's heard of them.
It's the name of the company. So he's doing $20 million third year in business.
Amazing. Can you share one or two of those truisms that you mentioned that everybody should stick by that are top of mind for you?
I'm going to remind you of the first one I mentioned. I don't think I named it. When I built that factory, took the risk to build that factory using money I had planned for my company. That's risk. Risk is one of the great truisms, right? It ain't a four-letter word. No way. It looks like it is, but it's not. It's your best friend. And how can I, you know, make it even more impressive? Think of Andy Warhol, okay? He was my generation, not yours, but everybody knows Andy Warhol. Andy Warhol was ostracized. His art was not considered art.
Mm-hmm.
He was trying to shake up the art world. He didn't want any part of it. He couldn't get in galleries. He had to do commercial stuff to make a living.
Right.
But he took that risk to stick with it and not worry about what they thought. He believed he was coming up with something the public would love and was new. You know, a few months ago, his Marilyn sold for $195 million.
Wow.
There has not been a painting that's ever sold for that except the Mona Lisa. You have to take risks. That's truism number one. Just to cut to the chase, not go through so many of them, I love imagination. I think in anything you do, imagination wins the day. And the truth is, you and I and everybody we know does not have the imagination we had when we were 6 years old.
No.
We went to school. We wanted to act like our friends. We wanted to fit in. We're following rules, textbooks. We lose it. I did learn that mantras and stories help remind you to do things a certain way. And I love this story that reminded me every time I had to do something creative and imaginative. So you just think of this little girl.
Okay.
She's like 6 years old. She's in kindergarten. Maybe she's 5 years old.
My son is almost six in kindergarten.
But this little girl was not a happy camper. Every day she'd sit in the back. Her mind, her eyes seemed to be elsewhere. Except one day a week they had drawing class. And when they had drawing class, she's got the pencil and she's got the pad and she doesn't lift her head up with a big smile on her face. And the teacher went over to her and said, Julie, what is that you're drawing today? Oh, she said, I'm drawing a picture of God. Oh, but Julie, honey, none of us know what God looks like. She looked up at the teacher and said, you will in a minute. I want to have that imagination. Mm. And we really did. And the people who worked for me learned how to think that way. So imagination is a truism you need in life, career, and business.
I love it.
Can I give you one more?
I would love it.
Because this is critical.
Yeah.
You cannot do it alone.
That's for sure.
You can't. You cannot be the best at every aspect of your life or your business. You can't be. There are others that can do certain things better than you.
No doubt.
Find them.
Yeah.
And don't skimp. Go for the best of the best, because the prestige of having them with you will pay for itself. You can't imagine how many times over. That's why I always went for Giselle and Kate Moss and Gigi Hadid and Mario Testino, the photographer, Zaha Hadid, who designed, great architect, world-renowned, signed stores for me. Those kind of people gave me something. Well, am I going to design a store that the world's going to say, wow, no. But Zaha did, or of course, I can't look in a shoe like Kate Moss would look. So I always went for the best, because you can't do it alone.
You bring up the Hadids. I was going to ask, has there ever been any conversation or conflict over their position on Israel?
I retired way before October 7th.
Mm-hmm.
So I never got involved in that. I hired Gigi. I got her sister for free, because they had the same shoe size. We'd send Gigi six pair, and she'd call up and say, my sister took four of my shoes. Can I get them again? So we got Bella running around, and we got both for the price of one. No, I never did. And we used Gigi for charities and for our ads, and she became very friendly with people in our company. Her father's Palestinian.
Yeah.
I get it. I don't criticize her. If, you know, her father's Palestinian. She's going to have a feeling that I don't.
That's very magnanimous.
Nah, it's just reality.
Another great initiative, let's call it, that you've been involved with is the National Museum of American Jewish History in Philadelphia, now known as the Weizmann. What did you love about that museum so much that you wanted to give such a meaningful gift that your name's now on the door?
You've done your research on me.
Oh, yeah. We get thorough here.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Oh, it's a good thing I've been a good husband.
Yeah. My research associate, Sam, she finds it all.
I went to Penn. You know, it's the museum there. Have you ever been to it?
I haven't yet.
It's on the corner of the Liberty Bell and the original U.S. Constitution. It's called Constitution Mall.
Right.
You cannot get a better location.
Yeah.
Sidney Kimmel helped make it happen. He's a
Kimmel Center?
Kimmel Center. A few years ago, the bank says, it's time to pay the principal. There's no money put aside to accumulate for that.
Mm.
So we're going to take the building. We're going to build a tower. We'll sell it to a real estate. The man who was desperately trying to find a way to save it had seen what I had done elsewhere. And my name's on the list of Jewish philanthropists somehow. I don't know why. And he tracked me down. I went again to see it, but this time with different eyes. I thought, gee, what a great location. And it's a wonderful museum. It's the only museum in America on American Jewish history.
Right.
Many Jewish museums on local Holocaust, et cetera.
Yeah.
But this is national. I got lucky. It didn't cost me anything to save it.
What do you mean?
Over my lifetime, I was like a collector of one-of-a-kind items.
Okay.
You know where I'm going, probably.
I do. Like stamps and coins, let's say.
And I had accumulated three one-of-a-kind items, not because they were stamps or coins, but because they were it. There was only one of each one. I try to buy the Declaration of Independence. And there are only two outside of the state's legislatures.
Nicolas Cage has the other one?
No, Bill Gates. Then I bought the inverted Jenny, which is a mistake in the stamp.
Okay.
It's the upside down airplane.
Okay.
And then I said, wait a minute, I have an international album too. And I went to that, and in the top of the front page, most valuable stamp of the world. It's called a 1 cent magenta British Guiana stamp.
Okay.
And they're sitting in museums on loan for years. And they're out, I haven't seen them. They're out of my mind. Occasionally there's a story about them. And then this thing happens in Philly. And I said to my kids, do you want the stamps and that coin? Daddy, it's your passion. What are we going to do with it? Give it away to museums because we don't want the problem. What are we going to do with it?
Right.
I said, okay. So I put them all three up for sale and all the money saved the museum.
I love that. That's a great story. Full of great stories, Stuart.
I don't tell you the bad ones.
Something else you're passionate about.
What is that?
Sports.
I love sports.
You are a four-time Maccabi Games participant and medalist.
Once a medalist.
Once, hey, it's more than me.
Bronze medal. Last time.
In, what was that, 2022?
Yep, and I'm going this summer for the silver.
Okay, and it's table tennis.
Yeah.
It's as an individual sport, it's a team sport.
They have doubles, team, and individual.
What will you be competing in?
I don't play doubles.
You do the team and the individual.
Yeah, I bump into my partner too much.
So when did you get into table tennis?
Didn't you play as a kid?
Yeah.
Everybody played as a kid. So all these guys are playing pickleball. I said, it looks like table tennis.
It's like going from regular chess to like the life-size chess.
Yeah, so I had a pool table. I bought a top, you know, sit on it. Yeah. You could play either one. And I started practicing. I said, I'm going to go to the Maccabi Games. I bought a robot. They are amazing. The ping pong robot is much better than like the
Forrest Gump only had a wall. You had a robot.
Oh, this thing is. And I trained and trained and trained.
Just for the Maccabi Games.
And I made the team. Now I play for fun, but my training was to go to get on the team at Maccabi.
And then in the last one, you also got to be the American team flag bearer. How was that experience?
That was as cool as anything.
Yeah?
1,000 athletes behind me, all waving little flags. I got the big one. You know how you march into it's just like the Olympics.
Right, into the stadium.
You know, we had 10,000 athletes, so it's 60-something countries. And I have the whole team behind me, and we march in our, you know, alphabetical order. It is so exciting. The opening ceremony, it's so thrilling. I mean, you got 60 countries and you're meeting people and you can't help the camaraderie.
Right.
And it's not because he's from Serbia and I'm from America. It's because we both go to synagogue.
Right.
You know?
We're all one tribe.
It really was.
I'm jealous hearing all these Maccabi stories. You know, it sounds like a really amazing experience.
I made a shidduch there.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Who?
Well, I saw these basketball team players from Argentina, like 6'2", 6'6", hunks. And these American girls who were swimmers are looking at them and giggling and looking at them and giggling. And I could tell they were trying to get attention. They didn't know how to approach. And of course, they speak Spanish and English. And
I said, Stuart Weitzman.
I said, I speak Spanish. Yeah. You want me to introduce you to those fellas? And shyly, well, I don't want to put you out. So it's señores, ven aquí. And I talked to them in Spanish. I said, these are three of our most fabulous swimmers. And they were admiring your uniform. I just made it up. And one guy says, oh, I speak English. Maybe the other two did too, but he said, I speak English. And then they're all talking and making, she says, can I trade you uniforms? Which they do at these games. Mm. Did you know that? It's sort of a custom. I have the Cuban team's t-shirt for table tennis. They have mine. She said, can I trade you uniforms? She takes off her shorts, takes it right to him. He can't get it past one leg. She's putting his on, they're swimming on her.
Right.
And they went out for Cokes.
There you go. How important is your connection to Israel to you?
It's in my blood. I laugh for them and I cry for them. Mm. I'm glad I feel that way. And I feel sorry for Jewish people who don't, because it's such a great sensation to have. Mm. It really is.
I couldn't agree with you more.
Yeah.
I want to talk about UPenn. So we've talked a little bit about your time there, but not in terms of philanthropy.
And you went there also.
I did. I didn't go to Wharton. I went to UPenn undergrad, the college. Uh-huh. You've called it your third child. At least that's what I read.
Yes.
Why is Penn so important to you?
It was my third child.
Okay. And now?
It's trying to work its way back into my heart.
Mm.
We have a good president. Mm-hmm. Liz McGill is not there anymore. She was a lovely lady, didn't have the backbone to stand up to what was right. Mm-hmm. This guy has been there a long time.
Larry Jameson.
Ran the medical school, dean, and top guy, and he's put in rules and been quiet campus.
Yeah.
They had a professor at Annenberg who painted these horrific anti-Semitic cartoons after the 7th, and they wouldn't fire him.
I know.
But he's not there this semester.
Right.
I don't know if he'll be there next semester. I'm waiting.
You didn't pull your money out.
Well, I gave a dollar.
This year you gave a dollar.
You know that dollar campaign? Do you know about that?
No.
It was Mark Rowan's idea. Very clever.
Okay.
If you don't give, they don't know you didn't give. Right? How would they know?
Mm.
But if you send in a dollar.
They know you just gave them a dollar.
You made a statement that they can't miss. So I became part of the dollar campaign, and I stopped any giving that I had planned on.
Oh, wow.
And I told him, get rid of that guy, then we can talk. He says, it's not up to me, Jameson. He said, I'd like to get rid of him and 20 others, but it's up to the dean of the Annenberg School. And I said, who does she work for? Well, you know who she works for. Him.
Yeah.
He said, me. I said, yeah. I don't want to have a riot on campus. We have to work this out. So finally he's gone.
Right.
He doesn't know if that dean will bring him back, but he doesn't think so because the course has been eliminated from the syllabus.
Right. And if there's no course, there's no professor. In September of 2023, this was before October 7th, you participated in the Shabbat Together event at the Penn Hillel.
That's because they had that Palestinian Rights Festival that was just horrendous.
Right.
That started the whole, Penn started it all.
That's right. So, I mean, for those people who don't remember, there was a Palestinian Literary Arts Festival. Which could have been fine. Mm-hmm. And maybe 80% of the people on the list to show up were there to do poetry and film and celebrate Palestinian culture. But then they kind of slid in that 10-20% of sort of pure anti-Israel.
And anti-Jewish.
And anti-Jewish folks, like Roger Waters, who's certainly not Palestinian.
Right.
And it caused a lot of controversy. How did you end up showing up right there in that immediate aftermath?
The head of Hillel said, we're going to have Liz McGill come talk to the Jewish students next week. And we'd like you to also. I said, how much time do you want me to talk? Well, we only have 20 minutes, and she's going to have 13, and you can have 7. So there were so many negative comments about her showing up at Hillel that the head of Hillel called the administration office and said, we think it's better that she doesn't come. Wow. So I got 20 minutes.
Hey, how do you feel about the future for Jewish Americans? Because you're someone who's, you're the American dream, you're the Jewish dream, you're proud of both.
It's fine. We're gonna
be all right.
Yeah. I don't know anyone directly who's suffered from the increased anti-Semitism. I read about so many, and I am involved in supporting lawsuits against a lot of universities. So I know what's going on. Other than Penn, but things pass, you know. We're talking about people who don't know. What makes this different is there are a lot of people in America, especially young people, who got tied into the oppressed philosophy.
Yeah.
And because Jews are successful, we have to be the oppressor. And Palestinians are downtrodden, not because of the Jews who left Gaza 20-some-odd years ago, right? But because of the way Hamas treats them. That's who ruled that. That was their own nation for 20 years. No one wants to recognize that, but that's what it was. And they've used the cement for tunnels instead of hospitals and universities. So they don't know that, but they're not going to even care about it. They don't understand it. They just know oppressed, oppressor, and they pick on us. And there are several million Middle Eastern students in our campuses That didn't exist 20 years ago.
Yeah.
And many, many hundred thousands of Middle Eastern professors, well supported by Qatar, Saudi Arabia also.
Mm-hmm.
And they've been planted there.
A lot of money
A lot of money in that, right? And that's the difference today. So you can't, there's no getting away from that. You just have to fight it with fire, which we didn't do, nor did America do last year.
No.
Trump is now fighting it with fire.
So you feel like we're on a better trajectory now?
Yeah, I don't think it's going to eliminate the way those people think, just like we're not going to eliminate the way Hamas thinks.
Right.
But if we can keep them out of the limelight and weakened, that's the most we can hope for.
Okay. What do you think is the most important way to instill Jewish pride in young people?
Comes from the parents.
That's for sure.
Teach them about the Jewish heritage. They have to do that. When I meet students who went to Jewish camp and are now grown up,
mm-hmm.
or went to Israel for birthright,
yep.
they have different attitude than even my children who didn't do either, which I regret now. But who knew? Because it was, like I said, I grew up in a synagogue. There was nothing to worry about.
Right.
Hewlett was a synagogue.
I think sort of the key takeaway is intentionality. And it's not something we can take for granted, no matter who we're surrounded by. If we don't intentionally make it important, it's not going to be important.
And look at the accomplishments of that startup nation.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the things they've invented, from the camera that goes in the body to the technology. They're working on hydrogen instead of now, you know, other kinds of energy, atomic. It's just amazing. They've won more Nobel Prizes in Israel than all of the Muslim world. How about that?
Yeah, not surprised.
You think that nice girl from New Jersey, not Jewish, who's a bit socialist, leftist leaning, always thinking, you know, like Bernie and those people, you think she knows that?
Certainly
not. And I wonder if she knew it, if it would matter to her.
That's probably the bigger question.
Yeah.
All right, well, let's end on something a little lighthearted. That we're going to do a little lightning round. I'm going to just throw some softballs at you, and you give me the quick answers.
Softballs, not hardballs.
Not hardballs, mm. Easy. Favorite shoe you've ever designed?
The first shoe I won an award for, a bridal shoe.
What was so special about it?
Made out of lace, like a wedding dress. Until then, shoes were made out of, for brides, acetate satin. They glowed in the dark because the girls didn't pay attention. The dress covered it.
Right.
But then the younger girls were starting to raise the length of their wedding gown. The shoes began to show, and we made this gorgeous pump that was a technological advance, too, because lace is cotton.
Right.
It breaks.
Sure.
I had to make the same designs out of nylon, which doesn't break. And we made a gorgeous shoe that won my first award. I remember flying home from London on the Concorde.
Hey.
To be there in time for the event.
Well, that'll help you get there.
That justified it.
What's someone you wish you'd had the chance to design for?
Marilyn Monroe.
Mm. That would have been special.
In fact, I use her as a model.
What do you mean?
Well, as a muse, let's say, as a muse.
Thinking about what would look great on Marilyn Monroe.
If Marilyn Monroe would wear that shoe I just sketched, then I know it's going to be a hot party shoe.
I love that. Who was the hardest to nail a design for?
Audrey Hepburn type customer. The chic, classic woman who has so much confidence, she doesn't need the high heel to empower herself. Because a shoe can change your personality, can change your life. I mean, I love Bette Midler. In our industry is remembered for having said, give me the perfect shoe and I will conquer the world. Fortunately for the world, I haven't found that shoe yet.
I like that.
That's Bette Midler.
Yeah, that's right. Who are some of your favorite designers that inspire you?
Louboutin. And I'll tell you why. A young lady might say, because his shoes are so sexy, which they are. I say, because he does what he loves, what he wants his ladies to wear, and he doesn't care what the fashion is. He just makes them super sexy. And if things are going on in lower heels or certain cowboy boots or over the knee boot, he doesn't want his women in them. He doesn't care. Most designers get caught into trends and mm-hmm. we try to make sure we get a piece of that action.
Right.
So I admire him for that. I really do.
Sure. Favorite Jewish holiday?
I love Hanukkah. because for some reason, my wife grew up with, remember, I mentioned she's in an area where there were not that many Jewish
where was she
people.
From
a suburb of Atlanta.
Okay.
Her parents, I guess to compete with Christmas, gave presents every night. And that's what we began to do with our kids.
Well, you're supposed to get 8 of them, right?
Yeah, and we haven't stopped.
Nice. What's your least favorite Jewish holiday?
The ones I don't know about, I don't pay attention. I mean, I had a friend who used to love the word Shmini Atzeres. I never found out what the heck Shmini Atzeres is.
You're the second guest on this show to basically say that same thing. He's like, I've heard of that. It's fun to say. Yeah. I don't know what it is.
I mean, he would say things like, now from now till Shmini Atzeres. And I would say, what the hell is that?
This is the being Jewish special. We ask this all the time. Challah, rip or slice?
Oh, no, you got to rip it.
There we
Does
go.
Does anybody slice challah?
A couple of people slice challah.
Are they Jewish?
I grew up slicing the challah. And now I'm more of a combo because I rip and then I slice so I can save some for the French toast the next day.
Uh-huh.
So you get a little both. Last question. You've given us so many truisms, but what's one of your sort of favorite nuggets to impart to others? Favorite business advice, life wisdom, anything?
Perception. And I believe perception is a ticket to a happy and successful life. When we would create a product, we would try to give it the best perception we could. When I started my company, I had, aside from making shoes on the red carpet custom that no one else was doing, I had an idea to launch my product in stores. I was going to make the most famous shoe in the mind of a young girl. You know what shoe that is?
Tell me.
I decided I was going to make a real-life Cinderella slipper.
Mm.
A glass shoe with a glass heel, but higher for when she's grown up, because I'm not selling four-year-olds.
Uh-huh.
Now, obviously, the glass is translucent PVC,
mm-hmm.
and the heel is Lucite plexiglass, not glass,
right.
But the look is the same. And it was really cool. And the editors went nuts over it. I'm going to get free publicity more than any ad I run. And I opened it up to the showroom. And I'm walking around listening to customers' commentary on the shoes the salesmen are presenting. And I told them, I want you to present this right off the bat. And here's the sales pitch. It's every girl's dream shoe. And not only that, it's $30 less than our leather shoes because of what it's made out of. And I heard a retailer say, oh, I don't buy plastic shoes. No. I heard someone else say the same thing within 5 minutes. I took the shoe out of the room, put it away. 15 years later, Disney redid Cinderella on Broadway.
Right.
I got a call. Could we make the Cinderella shoe for the Broadway show? And I did. And I thought, this is going to get a lot of press. I love that shoe. The editors love that shoe.
Right.
I'm going to redo it. But this time, I'm going to price it $50 more than a leather shoe.
Mm.
Because it had its cost, which I had a nice profit on.
Right.
Why? Because the retailers, the consumer, no longer saw it as a plastic shoe.
Right.
It was now a novelty shoe.
Luxury item.
With a story.
Mm.
And that was the perception of the shoe. And I used perception everywhere I could, whenever I could. And I recognize that we are all salespeople, and we have to be perceived in the best possible way for whatever the purpose is. And if we do that, I don't see how we can't succeed.
Well, you've certainly sold me, Stuart. You're a legend. Thank you so much for being here. This has been so awesome. Learned a lot from you. I know my audience has. And thank you for being here.
Okay, it's been my pleasure.
An enormous thank you to Stuart Weitzman for chatting with me today and meeting me here in New York City, where neither of us live. Please, please, please make sure to subscribe to the podcast, even if you watch on TV. Those numbers really help us. And make sure to sign up for our newsletter at www.jonahplatt.com. Scroll down to the bottom. You can fill your email in right there. Y'all are the best. I'll see you right back here for the next iconic episode of Being Jewish with me, Jonah Platt. Big ups to everyone who makes this show possible every week. my executive producer, Matthew Jones, story producer, Sean Liviashvili, and editor, Mike O'Brien of Rainbow Creative, consulting producer, Bethany Mandel, research associate, Samantha Greenwald, my amazing executive assistant, Josie Rothschild, social media manager, Yuval Yosha, and graphic designer extraordinaire, Noah Bell. Most of all, thanks to you, dear listeners, who even stuck around to listen to all these credits. And I freaking love you guys.